It's always dubious honour closing out the day because on the one hand you get to give the last punch for the day, on the other hand you may not have everyone, half of you may be asleep. So what I really want to talk about today is something I hope to convince you is very simple. So I'm going to try to convince you that what I've done is fairly trivial. Because it's something I'd like to see done a lot more often. And that's where you look at a piece of technology and say, right, these are our pieces, this is what we can play with, this is how we can put it together, how likely is it to work? Because there's lots and lots of papers that look at, say, an individual piece, even a whole computer, but then don't go that last step and say, well, how likely is the whole setup to work? So the actual particular example I'm going to be looking at today is probably not even that simple to my own interest. So we're looking at superconducting flux qubits, but it's largely for the exercise of saying, well, will this system work or not? And we'll see in the end, I'll give you the punchline now, that this is a very challenging system to scale up. We'll look at the reasons exactly why. So firstly, what do we mean by scalable? You know, so many people, particularly people that struggle at the coalface, building 1 or 2 qubits, a system is scalable if you can implement more than 1 or 2, more than you already have, right? And that's good enough. But in practice, you need to have an arbitrary large number. Otherwise, you're not going to do anything significant in the world of computation. And so within that constraint, we're going to have a look at whether we can actually make a flux qubit quantum qubit scalable. And so there's a natural number of steps, what our technology is, how we couple it, how we do some long-range coupling, you see that's very necessary. We need to do a few quick words about error correction, but not much, because most of the stuff has already been covered today, so I can skip through a number of slides. And then what all of our error correction implies in terms of how you need to wire up the network of qubits, how you calculate the threshold for when it all works, and then the major challenges to do better. So just to belabor the issue, we want an arbitrary number of qubits. We really do need the number of gates for linearly equipped number of qubits, so we can do error correction on all parts of the computer in a density that doesn't change. Similarly, for the same reason, we need dense measurement. And crucially, as we add more bits to our computer, it shouldn't change the physics of any small part of it. So measurement should get harder if I have 1,001 or 1,000 qubits. It should be completely independent of that. So furthermore, we can't have things that are unfortunately used in the superconducting world. That's frequency crowding, because you have big manufacturing differences between the qubits. They rely on small gaps between the pieces of the superconductor. These gaps vary. The energy of your qubit depends exponentially on the size of the gap, so they're not uniform. Many people use this as a feature because they can build 2, 3, 4 qubits and say, they'll have different frequencies, we don't need to do anything, we can address them. But this is not a scalable approach. Similarly, because you can couple these things with resonators, capacitors, inductors, it's very easy to put multiple qubits in some kind of box. And again, that's fine for a few qubits, but as soon as these things can't talk to each other densely, can't do many, many interactions at the same time, it doesn't scale. Yes, sir?
Would you say frequency addressing is not scalable?
Well, it's certainly not with superconducting qubits, because if you have 1,000 qubits in a small area and you've got one global source of microwaves that's to address all of these things, you need weaker and weaker pulses to selectively address just one qubit at a time.
Right, but linearly, right?
Linearly in what sense?
You have to, I guess, shine your laser, whatever you shine microwave source for longer, but only a time that scales linearly.
But that doesn't scale. I mean, if your computer's getting linearly slowly more slow as you add more qubits, faster than the time your gates take longer than your decoherence time. I mean, that's a fairly trivial statement, but, you know, it's not scalable for that reason. So what do we pick as our starting point? So again, I'm not claiming this is the best starting point, but just the exercise, take technology, does it work or not? John Clark's group in Berkeley had a nice little idea. We take 2 little rings of superconducting metal, these are our qubits, counter-rotating currents, find our different computational states. We wrap another loop around the outside, and for reasons that I'm not going to go into great detail, that allows us to tunably couple these 2 qubits. They have a direct interaction, and the extra loop allows us to turn it off. So, as it stands, this is fairly useless for building a computer. It's 2 qubits coupled. Closely coupled, if I add more qubits to this, we have all sorts of crosstalk issues. So this is a starting point, but it's not enough. So the obvious shortcoming is particularly obvious. It's short. So nearest neighbor doesn't buy you a lot when it comes to error correction. You pay a huge penalty in the number of gates, as we can see. And it's instructive just to put together this very brief and selective group of papers where essentially we've got lots of qubits and unlimited range interactions all the way down to not very many qubits and nearest neighbor interactions. You just pay for it in threshold. Why? Well, if we have conceptually a 3-qubit logical qubit and another 3-qubit logical qubit, we want them to interact. We have long-range interactions. This is easy. 3 gates, done. But if we only have nearest neighbor interactions, we immediately run into a big problem if we're only using a single error correcting code, because if one of the swap gates required to get these qubits close enough to interact in pairs fails, the errors propagate and then copy, and we then have multiple errors in each logical code void. So even to do anything with a single error correcting code, you need to have 2 lines of qubits. And sure, that allows us to move things around without simultaneously touching 2 data qubits, but you now have both more qubits and an awful lot more gates. And just by eye, you can see that if all of this needs to work as well as all of that, the gates need to be a lot better. And hence, the threshold gets driven down. So we want long-range interactions. It turns out that our particular choice of system, it's fairly easy to do this. You just put more metal in between these 2 things. They're superconductors. In principle, you might think, well, I've heard of transmission lines in superconducting technology that go tens of kilometers. And that was, I guess, our initial hope looking at this system. Can we go a really, really long way? But life's not that kind to us. As we increase the amount of wire we have between these 2 qubits, we also increase the inductance of the loop. As we increase the inductance, we essentially have itty-bitty little quantum objects trying to move something enormous and classical, and past a certain point, this just doesn't work. And that certain point, unfortunately, turns out to be a few millimeters, which is still pretty macroscopic, but you have to keep in mind these qubits aren't that small either. So 50 by 50 micrometers. So even in the best case, if we were looking at, say, 4 millimeters as our maximum range, 50 by 50 micrometers, there's a whole bunch of wires, as we see, that need to sort of cover all of the necessary area between. This minimum separation of these is about 200 micrometers. You're talking something, best-case scenario, would have a range of about 20 qubits. But even then, it's not that good. We have crosstalk issues. So sure, if we have coupled between a pair of qubits, that can cancel out the coupling between that pair. We have lots of pairs of qubits in our system. If there's no coupler between them, we have no direct way of cancelling that interaction. So if we can be able to cope with the system, so have not too many qubits close by so you can take into account the fact that some of them are always on interacting, you need to keep them fairly far apart. And fairly far apart means almost a millimetre, 0.65 millimetres, just to have a low enough direct interaction to have some hope building something that will be able to ignore that always-on interaction. So we're down to really just 5 or 6 qubit systems. And that's what we've got to play with. That's what we've got to play with and see what we can do in the world of error correction. So as has been talked about a number of times today, there are some wonderful papers out there on thresholds for fault-tolerant computation, but they have severe assumptions in that you need lots of qubits, and in this particular case by Manny and Nil, you need very, very long-range interactions. You prepare lots of states offline, one of them succeeds, and then you need to interact back with your data, and your data's a long way away. So with a range of 5 or 6 qubits, we're not going to be able to do that. Next step down is really the work by steam. Again, it's substantially similar. You have Ansela factories. Okay, the state you need to prepare is smaller, but you still need to do this lots of times, one of them succeeds, then you need to interact with your data. And with just 5 or 6 qubits range distance, this is not the path we wanted to go down. So the way we intend to do it, the way we have focused on, is really the latest work by DiVincenzo, where he looked at eliminating the verification stage. So you always have a fixed number of qubits in our scheme. You'd never bother with an entire Ansela factory, prepare your Ansela state, interact, decode, measure, And because we just don't have enough range, if you just live with that and see how good it's going to be. So one of the reasons I'm standing here is to see if we can get a few more ideas to do it better, because as we will see, this doesn't work all that well. Then you can play games with how do you lay it out. So this is the circuit we need, these are our qubits, all the little squares, and then you can just link them up. So you can see the first three series of interaction pairs here, our couplers just correspond to these three gates, and so on. We have one between the last two, that's this one. So there's a coupler between every pair of qubits that needs to interact. You just design a circuitry to reuse as many of these couplers as possible, because you don't want to build lots. You can see there's five couplers just around this one qubit. That's not easy to build, okay? So you've got to keep the number down. And that's not all. This is, of course, just one logical qubit. We have seven physical qubits representing our data qubit. The next one up here is our ancilla state, so that corresponds to all of these qubits up here. And the one up here is for universality. That's for doing a pi over 8 rotation or a T gate, depending who you talk to. So where do we go from there? We have this block, which is our logical qubit. We then need to go up to our next level pair of question, or at the very least, where's the rest of the computer? And we still have the same problem. We can't just put a great big line of all these logical blocks. We have to avoid logical nearest neighbor errors. So we still need this second line. And now we're looking at putting those 21 qubits and all that fancy network in each one of these holes. So what does that look like? Well, we take our bilinear network and we stretch it, and then we insert it all in. And then the big question is, well, we have a network. That's great. We can continue this in principle for a long way. I'll talk a little bit about how far we can do this. There are limits to the size of chip you can build, about 30 centimeters. But you also need to be able to control lines in. And as we'll see, this is probably the biggest limitation of this approach. You just need a lot of wire. And one more level up. So now each of these represents both lots of groups of 21, and then at bilinear as well. This is now essentially just pure linear nearest neighbor circuitry with the feature that we have, fault tolerant swap gate, so we can get data qubits past each other without them touching. So it allows us to build linear nearest neighbor networks for our third and higher levels of error correction. Three being a number that most people feel is enough to give you access to a large and interesting computation. So that's our design. We need a few more details later if I can skim through and get to it. And then we need our threshold. So let's just pretend for a moment that this circuit, which is a lot easier to focus on than this guy, was something really interesting and did something called tolerant, meaning it could tolerate single error anywhere. It can't, but let's just use it for argument's sake. Well, we want to know the probability that it fails, and it turns out to be extremely convenient to do it in the following manner. Instead of counting the number of pairs and triplets of locations where we can get an error, well, let's just count all the places where it will work. So we focus on 1 minus probability of success. And firstly, that's just the product of the probability that everything works. So that's our first line here. And then the probability of having a single error in any different type of our components. And it's a nice way of analyzing, because you can put in an arbitrary number of different types of components, some fancy way of moving data without using a CNOT gate or a special 2-qubit readout. It doesn't really matter. It doesn't really make analysis any more complicated. You just have another line. You can also do a little bit better, because these are all the ways that our circuit can succeed. We can also sit down and manually look for places where pairs of errors also allow the circuit to succeed, and just add more terms down to this polynomial. I don't need to talk about this. John Pestle did at the beginning of the day. This is how much circuitry we need to include in our circuit that we count the locations of. You need an extended rectangle, not just a rectangle. We need to have a universal set of gates, and in particular, the threshold that we care about is the threshold of when does our most complicated gate work, which turns out to be the T gate, or pi over 8 gate. So this is really the piece of circuitry we care about. And then you have to count locations. So these are big, big circuits. And of course, because we have three different, you have all of this in each one of those. You have a double row of 21 of this inside each one of these. We have three different layers of slightly different circuitry. So you have to construct four different polynomials for each level. You can plug them in, but it's really just, again, a very, very simple mathematical script. And that allows you then to plot the probability that our TA, our logical TA of an arbitrary level of encoding, works given a particular failure rate. And the failure rate we really want to focus on is not so much a swap failure rate, that's the terminology used, but swap is just a generic representation of a completely arbitrary two-bit gate. So the search tree for swap is slightly more complicated than, for example, doing a CNOR, control phase, so we can use it as an upper bound on the failure rate of all of our two-bit gates. And then everything else we just put proportional to that failure rate. So we say that if you're not touching a qubit, it's less likely to fail. Do nothing, less likely to fail. The tenth, the probability of failure. Readout, we make equally likely as a two-qubit gate to fail. And we also play around with the time. So superconducting technology, the time of readout is usually fairly slow, so 10 times the time of the gate. And that's enough to fix everything with a single parameter, solve, for example, effectively an infinite number of layers of error correction. 100 is as good as an infinite number of levels for all practical purposes, and see when you get improvement and when you don't. Yes?
Just a question. You're fixing that readout time, but aren't you using the scheme where the slow increments, you know, are
sure.
The same? So it actually doesn't matter so much with that readout time?
It does matter. It does matter for the simple reason that, sure, we are using this particular scheme, but the main reason we use it is to avoid an ancilla factory, so lots of ancilla states. We've got our data qubit flying along down here. The next stage of error correction can't begin until the measurements are finished, qubits are being reset, a logical state is being prepared again, which is this part of the circuit. So the
measurement... Or you can just keep it just poorly framed on the side.
To even begin another set of error correction, we need to finish the measurement here. Or we need a fresh set of ancilla qubits. Right.
Okay, yeah, you need another.
And because we have short range. Because we have short range interactions, we don't have another fresh set of ancilla qubits. It impacts, but it's not too bad. Alright, and then the extra details. So, even what I've been discussing is really nowhere near enough. You need to then sit down and really try to wire up your computer. So this is just focusing on the bilinear case because it was easier to draw. In principle, we did this for the more complicated geometry, but it's not really visible on screen like this. So the main limiting factor, it turns out, is, well, we've got to get all these control lines across some imaginary border where we have qubits and outside we have control lines. And for the more complicated geometry, you actually run out of width. So you've got a completely dense set of wires all the way along here getting into your qubits. And that was somewhat depressing because while we had, you know, a network of this form, the hope was definitely to go to situations where we have even more non-local, two or even three levels of non-local error correction. But for this particular set of technology, you just can't get the wires in. You can't control a more dense arrangement of qubits. So, and there are many other issues we play around with here. I didn't talk about readout. You actually do readout in pairs. You use one of these couplers resonantly to determine simultaneously the state of two qubits. We need to work out the details of that. At the moment, it's actually too fast. It's too fast and it generates an output voltage that oscillates in a nice way, but too quickly you'd actually detect it. So we need to slow that down while not damaging the coupling properties of it. And more, you obviously have to build this thing and keep it cold, ideally right down to the tens of millikelvin level. And then you end up with this situation. You can imagine your chip here, and it has all of these micro machine wires. Then you need to fan them out to coaxial cables. You need to look at the amount of heat that all of these wires bring down into your computer, into your fridge, whether you can cool it. Turns out you can, it just is very expensive. It requires a lot of refrigeration. So this is something that we're writing up right now. We just worked it out a couple of weeks ago. So that's not your big problem. It's, again, wire density. Crosstalk and shielding. At the moment, we have just a plain chip. Crosstalks. We talked about separating everything by 0.65 millimeters. That doesn't mean they're not talking. It just means they're not talking very much. So we need to actually, if possible to case these things in boxes to get rid of that sort of error. And chip spanning, we can only have about 30 centimeters in the best case scenario of this chip, because that's how they're built. We have a disk, 30 centimeters across, build it. Well, then what? How do we get our infinite number of qubits that I claimed we were going to? You actually need to think, well, we have two lots, 30 centimeters, how do we join them? So we're looking at flip chips and different designs for actually spanning across that gap. And that is extremely challenging, to get something coherent to couple two of these qubits on a flip chip. And even more than that, why algorithms without error correction? Well, keep in mind our threshold is about 5 × 10⁻⁶. Superconducting qubits, the ratio of decoherence time to gate time is only about 100 or so. And there has been a fair bit of effort. So we're already asking for four more orders of magnitude just to get to the threshold. And as I'm sure everyone in this room knows, the threshold's no good. You've got to beat it significantly, otherwise you wouldn't bother in the first place. So certainly this design motivates us, if we want to do a lot more with superconducting technology, to find out just how much you can do with an algorithm and no error correction. Can you do interesting simulation work just with raw qubits? What error rate? How many gates? What kind of problem? Can you beat a classical computer without error correction? I don't think that's been adequately addressed. Everyone believes, well, sure, scalable, you need error correction, but what can you do without? Because we've got really very good choice in this technology. And hopefully, I've convinced you that it's not that hard to do this for an arbitrary piece of technology. It's just polynomials. We want to see more of it. Because there's lots and lots of technologies that should be eliminated because they're similarly extremely challenging to actually do. And on that note, thank you.
Questions?
Yeah.
So these threshold numbers that you have are proofs, right?
Yeah.
So have you also done simulations to...
That's one thing we'll do next, but yeah, you're right.
Well, noise modulus is the adversarial noise.
This
model?
Is adversarial.
Okay. Not the
polar. No, not the polar. Mm. Yeah. So a qubit fails, it can't unfail with another error. Every gate copies as badly as it can.
Do you have a picture of the real chip?
I would love to. So I was down at Syracuse talking to Brent Ford, who was associated with the original effort. I am going to Berkeley to talk to John Clark in a few weeks. If I can encourage someone to take some stuff, that would be fantastic. So that's the goal, but we'll see. Yeah?
If we calculate the field probability, the epsilon quotient doesn't change.
Sure.
Why are there coefficients in front of those, like, lines?
That would be because I made a mistake in the slide. But you're right. There are some extra... so there are three different reset gates. There should be a three. Yeah. I'm glad someone picked me up. But yeah.
For the correct
point.
Are you sure you don't work for D-Wick?
But it's quite true, you know, there are three reset gates that should be, there are two gates that should be, it's better than the first version, which was done a lot quicker. For some reason, all the multiplications become minus signs, and then you're in serious trouble. Yeah, good point.
Could you just remind me why you didn't want to go with a... Ancilla verification / factory approach?
Well, we'd love to, but you need long-range interactions. Otherwise, you've got all of these ancillas floating around. Success. Here's your data. Then what? You've got to swap it all down. Now, that may work out better, but it means, at least as far as I can see, you're going to be applying error correction less often. And then it's a non-trivial question. Is a really guaranteed, and it's never really completely guaranteed, clean ancilla and lots of swaps better than no ancilla verification, decoding, and then measurement.
Yeah, but the ancilla factory doesn't need to be that large. I mean, like in our scheme of 2D rabbits, we have like
exactly.
That's it's going to be done locally, but yeah.
The next step would, for example, well, let's just add two ancilla batteries, right, working in tandem. So that we could do with 5 or 6 qubit range and see if it actually buys us anything.
Yeah.
Of course, it costs you qubits. So,
but this is a steam column you're using, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And you also have to ask yourself, well, just exactly how much will that give us? Even if it worked really well, it might give us a factor of 2 or 3 or 4. find it hard to believe it'd give us a factor of 10 or anything. Factor 2 or 3 or 4 won't save us.
I know that, I'm not the expert on this, but I know at IBM, you assume that the wires go into the plane, right, that you can't put, go from the top. But I know that Robert Cook at IBM has thought about that.
Sure. The immediate answer is, okay, you're now on another level. With all of these little dots you've got to control, well, then what? Where do the wires go?
You do the two-dimensional cell thing that we analyze.
No, I understand.
That's on the plane,
these things could, in principle, come straight out into the chip or on a back surface. And people talk about these, for example, in ion tracks, controlling all their fancy gates and electrodes just going down through the chip and having all the control circuitry off the back. Now, that's fine, but in our case, the control circuitry is rather non-trivial because these guys go to fairly fancy microwave generators, and the microwave generator is big.
Right?
Oh,
okay.
So putting something that can generate between 2 and 10 gigahertz to an accuracy of 1 part in 10 to the 6 on a chip, small, heat dissipation such that we don't mess up that 25 millikelvin at the bottom. At the moment, we don't feel that that's a reasonable assumption. So the assumption is you have to get a coaxial cable all the way out. So prospects for integration everything on the chip locally are not great. Not impossible, but it's no one has any ideas how you do it. But yeah, sure, we'd love to, right? Because then you could have qubits, a mesh of classical control circuitry, and then you can do 2D tiling and all sorts of things. Right? And even just 2D nearest neighbor buys you an order of magnitude. Right. And that would be certainly worth doing, but we don't know how. Yep.
Just a general question, just to sort of calibrate how much power we're talking about, do you have a rough estimate of how much microwave power for your entire...
Sure. It is a lot, but you've got to understand that most of it is dissipated up here. Right? Because you have a microwave generator and you're working in, maybe the 10 milliwatt range at the generator. So lots and lots of power compared to this level of the fridge, which is only going to fall maybe a few hundred microwatts. And that's per line, right? But it's mostly up here. So most of the heat is dissipated in the attenuators. You start off with a great big microwave, and then for noise reasons, you attenuate it down by 10. So almost all the heat is dissipated here, and you end up with several kilowatts of heat dissipation up here. So great big cryophores up here. But it still works out. You have to play a few games, but it still works out. And then so on. You have less attenuation here, better cryopools, lower temperature. But we did play the game, and it's a lot of technology, but you can take care of the problem. Wiring is really a big challenge.
Okay, thanks.